You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
What?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Cambridge 105, community radio for your city. Many thanks to Kevin Peters, as always, for the last 2 hours, but now, at just past midday, it's time for Bums on Seats, the fortnightly rummage and review among the latest cinema releases. My name is Mark Liversidge, and joining me on the show today are Emma Marchant.
Hello.
Simon West.
Hello.
And Steph Smith.
Hello.
As Cassius said to Brutus, the fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings. Despite two of today's films being set among the stars, they all in their own way look at the human condition that concerned Cassius. The humans might be the underlings in the Marvel Universe, but Natalie Portman gets the chance to go toe-to-toe with Chris Hemsworth and his family of demigods across the Nine Realms in Thor: The Dark World. There's also a power struggle in Short Term 12, this time between the children and their supervisors at a foster care home. The struggle between journalist Martin Sixsmith and the subject of his story form the basis for Philomena, as Steve Coogan and Judi Dench travel half the world in the search for truth. And we're caught on the border of the stars with Sandra Bullock searching for her own scrap of humanity while trying to simply stay alive in gravity. Plus, we talk to freelance writer Michael Brook about the season of Jan Svankmajer animated feature films that begins at the Cambridge Arts Picture House next Monday with a screening of The Marvellous Alice and offers a cornucopia of strange delights throughout November and December. But before all that, we're 372 miles above the Earth.
Explorer, this is Houston.
Go ahead, Houston.
Mission abort. Repeat. Mission abort.
Explorer, this is Kowalski confirming visual contact with debris. Debris is from a BSC sat.
Hitler.
Repeat. I have already.
Dr. Stone requesting faster transport.
We have to go. We have to go. Go, go.
Kennedy reports meteorological conditions. Don't go.
Explorer's been hit. Explorer. Astronaut is off structure. Dr. Stone is off structure. Dr. Stone, detach.
No.
You must detach. If you don't detach, that arm's going to carry you too far. Listen to my voice. You need to focus. I'm losing visual of you. In 2 seconds, I won't be able to track you. You need to detach. I can't see you anymore. Do it now. Houston, I've lost visual, Dr. Stone.
Despite the number of superheroes, spaceships, explosions and robots that feature over a typical cinema summer, commercial cinema tends to avoid the hard science fiction of ideas. The long-anticipated Gravity, several years in the making and even longer in development, is only possible through a number of technical achievements and by pushing the boundaries of both CGI and practical effects. The most significant challenge is to meld these developments with director Alfonso Cuarón's fondness for long, continuous shots. Gravity's opening shot lasts over 15 minutes, and the film's cinematography is intended to evoke documentaries rather than standard narratives. Sandra Bullock plays Dr. Ryan Stone, a rookie astronaut we meet taking baby steps on her first spacewalk. She is coaxed along by the reassuring words of George Clooney's Matt Kowalski, a veteran astronaut overseeing his final mission. Meanwhile, on the other side of the planet, a Russian missile destroys a satellite, resulting in a wave of debris that destroys the shuttle and separates Stone and Kowalski from their route back to Earth. In order to survive, Stone may need to confront more than just orbiting debris, as she grapples with the personal events that originally led her into space. Steph, Gravity has been widely lauded as creating a new benchmark in terms of CGI realism and 3D filmmaking, but is there enough of a story or a heart behind the effects?
Well, let's start with the effects. The trailer that you've just heard, if you haven't seen the visuals to it, it's probably just noise. Whereas I heard that and I had goosebumps, I got an adrenaline rush because I had all the visuals and the story that actually went with it. So absolutely yes, the visuals are top-notch and stunning, and the story behind it had me on the edge of my seat throughout. It is... It redefines the idea of a roller coaster ride film. To me, a roller coaster ride film is something cheap, disposable, like a roller coaster ride. This had the tension, the excitement of a roller coaster, but I actually want to go and see it again.
Simon, I'll come to you. I think the intent of something like Quarren is to actually make you feel as if you are in space. Almost all of what we actually see on screen is actually some form of effect. In some shots, only the faces are actually the real elements on the screen. Have we managed to avoid the uncanny valley? Is this a genuinely believable depiction of space?
I mean, I would debate that because, well, as far as I can understand from what I saw, they filmed it in space. I don't know how they got everybody up there, how they got the insurance, everything, but this, everything just seemed so real up there. The effects are amazing. This is film, one of the things a lot of people have been saying about it is if you can, see in 3D. I mean, I'm a big proponent of 3D, but when you even had, I think, Mark Kermode, who absolutely hates it, saying see it in 3D, do so with the movements, the choreography. Because it's in space, it doesn't have a lot of the problems that 3D can traditionally have, and it just puts you right there with them throughout every moment of this.
Mm. I think there's two things about the 3D for me. The first is that when the opening shot pans in towards the shuttle, my fear of heights, which has been quite bad over the years, genuinely started to kick in, and I felt as if I was falling in towards the screen. I had a slight moment of panic. But also, at certain moments when things like the space station are getting hit with debris, I was dodging out of the way, and I think that's the first time I've ever done that in a 3D film.
Yeah, just the movements in the camera, it's the fact that it feels like it's floating around everywhere. The cinematography and, as Steph mentioned, the effects are just so top-notch. But it's not just an effects film. I do, we've been talking about that, but you asked earlier whether it's a heart, and it is. It's the characters. You really do feel with them, and the terror. I mean, it's basically a disaster movie, but the feeling and the terror of being in that situation is just unbelievable.
You say it's a disaster movie. I kind of want to just jump on that, because there are two kinds of disaster movies. There are the ones that focus on what's going wrong and how awful it is, and there's ones that focus on the people, how it affects them, the heroism of them, how what is going on transforms those people. And this is very much the latter film. To say it's a disaster movie, I think, doesn't do it justice.
Emma, if I can bring you in. At one point in the development, it's been so long in development, this was actually due to be starring Robert Downey Jr. and Natalie Portman. It's been a remarkably evolving process.
That would have been a whole different movie. Maybe it wouldn't.
Yeah, I think maybe George Clooney and Robert Downey Jr. are slightly more interchangeable in terms of what they would have brought to this role. But how are
I don't Clooney know, though, if you would think of... I made the crack before we came on the scene on there that obviously miscongeniality is what made me want to go and see Gravity, but that's slightly facetious. I don't know if you would expect, if you think you know what Sandra Bullock does, which tends to be, she's got great comic timing, she does great romantic comedies, she has obviously done drama before, but I was not expecting... like Simon said, I was not expecting to be so completely drawn in. It really is her film, it's her film probably more than Clooney's film, and she is the heart and soul of it, and she is incredible, I think. And Clooney is also, Clooney, he's exactly as you think he should be in many ways. He has that kind of the charm that Clooney has, that old school charm. He does a beautiful job of kind of reassuring her at the beginning, because he is the astronaut who's been around, done it before, and she hasn't. She's the newbie, and he does a wonderful job in that. But I think if you have to give this film to someone, it is Sandra Bullock, and she does. She plays this role of a mother, someone who's lost something, someone who's up there in the sky, and the terror and everything, and she engulfed me. She she really did. It was, I thought she was incredible, and she deserves all the plaudits she's getting. So quite a part, because you want to almost try and stop thinking about the effects and just see it really as almost, it's almost a two-hander in space, and yeah, you know, it's absolutely incredible, incredible locale. And it doesn't fall down on that part. It can't have been the easiest thing to film, I wouldn't imagine, with the positions you've got to be in. And, yeah, bringing your technical stuff back into it, for her to maintain that heart throughout it, I think, yeah, brilliant, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And I saw it a month ago, and I can't wait to go and see it again now that it's opened here. I saw it in 2D. It was great in 2D. I can't wait to go and see it in 3D.
Has anyone apart from me actually seen it in 3D?
I've seen it in 3D. I'm not a fan of 3D in general. And this is probably one of the few films that do actually work in 3D. There's a couple of little artifacts here and there. For example, when you've got a very bright contrast, you get a triple image on screen. But actually, I'd like to see it in 2D to see whether or not I actually prefer one or the other.
Sure.
Yeah.
In terms of the story, some of the commentators have noted that there's maybe some religious aspects to the story, in it seems to be driving the fact that science isn't providing all the answers. Every time Sandra Bullock and George Clooney's characters try and look for another scientific solution, that's letting them down. Is that reading too much into the story? Is it more of just a simple adventure narrative?
There is a lot to read into the story if you wanted to. There's a lot about rebirth and finding yourself. There's quite a scientific explanation for it, where it's just more about how human life exists on Earth, because I think one of the taglines is you cannot live in space. But, you know, whether many of these are religious aspects or not, you can either take them in and read a lot into it, which there is, which you can do in repeated viewings, but it's not the important part of the film because it doesn't hit you over the head with it that much.
It could be why it's such a success.
It could be either. You can either take that, or if you take that away from the film, it doesn't detract at all from the film.
I think I'm going to half agree with both of you on that. It's kind of...
I didn't say anything. Go on.
Well, you're kind of nodding to Simon there, so I'm going to assume complicity. I didn't see the religious aspect as being part of the film. I think that's something you might bring to it, because the film is putting people in a situation of crisis where it peels off all the layers of social nicety and leaves them back with exactly who they are, and then leaves them at a point where they've got to find something within them, find some strength to overcome the trials that are facing them. Now, that to me is a very typical either a religious how I found God kind of story, or a humanist how I overcame adversity story. And I don't see that it actually brings in God at any point. To me, it just peels it down to that layer and then lets you interpret it in whatever way you want.
See, actually, I was going to agree with you. I was going to say that's perhaps why it's been such a successful film. It is a very simple narrative. It's a very short film. You know, it's 91 minutes. It's a simple narrative. And like we said before, there's barely any characters in it. So you, as a viewer, there are many things that you maybe take away from it. All of them good, I would say, though.
Yeah.
I kind of agree with you in that I read this as well. A lot of people have been reading religious allegories and certain characters they've been seeing as, and I didn't personally see that, but I can see how you could do so. All power to it. If it can give people that kind of response, then he's made an incredible, you know, it's an incredibly successful piece of filmmaking.
Mm. The other thing that struck me, particularly in regards to Alfonso Cuarón's filmmaking, we know he's a fan of long takes. Much has been made of the opening 17-minute shot of actually, you know, almost makes you feel as if you're in space floating around. Once that's then passed and you almost accept that you are in space with these characters, does the film then sustain past that initial novelty value? Because a lot of the action, as intense as it is similar elements that are repeating. You know, it's, again, moving from point A to point B, similar actions at point B to try and get to point C. So does that sustain over the 90 minutes?
It not just sustain, it builds. There's lots and lots of little details that are just background details within a space station, or about how a person's body reacts in zero G, that just bring back the situation of exactly where you are, exactly the environment you're in. There's one bit that I wish had been in the trailer, because I thought it was a phenomenal bit of filmmaking that didn't spoil plot, and that is Sandra Bullock crying in Zero Gravity, where we're so used to seeing tears clinging to somebody's face running down, and to see them literally just pop out of the tear duct and float was, I thought, artistically incredibly beautiful.
But in some ways, how great that wasn't in a trailer, because when I saw that, I and I think many other people in the cinema, you just gasp. It's like you say, it's gasp-inducing. And in some ways, if you'd seen that on the trailer four or five times beforehand, as it was, it comes in at that moment in the film, and it's just something else in what is an incredible hour and a half experience.
I mean, throughout the entire film, I was, like I said, on the edge of my seat. I don't know why Sandra Bullock had problems breathing fine oxygen. I didn't breathe throughout the entire film, I'm sure of it. But there are those moments where just when you think you've seen everything, something else comes on, whether it's a camera shot or something else, and it just makes you gasp again. It is just a phenomenal piece of filmmaking.
It sounds as if this is one occasion where we all agree this actually lives up to the hype.
Yay! Absolutely.
Gravity opened yesterday and is screening at all three Cambridge cinemas, both in 3D and 2D. And I think this is one where we can all comfortably recommend the 3D for those that have seen it. Of course, if you wish to see it in true IMAX, you'll have to travel down to London. It's a certificate 12A. Steve Coogan has done more to define his own career than any other media commentator could have done, especially with stage shows with names such as Alan Partridge and other less successful characters. Coogan may have become synonymous with his alter ego of more than 20 years, but those other characters represent a significant body of work. Much of that work has been produced by the production company Baby Cow he started with Henry Normal, and that's also allowed Coogan regular opportunities for film roles, from 24-hour Party People to A Cock and Bull Story. It's now enabled what may be as momentous a role for Steve Coogan, the writer and producer, as Partridge has been for Coogan, the actor. Having optioned Martin Sixsmith's book without even reading it in 2009, Coogan has brought on board a high-profile collection of British talent, including director Stephen Frears, to realise its heartbreaking tale of injustice and family ties. Coogan plays Sixsmith, an ex-BBC foreign correspondent drifting into aimlessness after being made redundant, whilst Judy Dench is Philomena Lee, an Irish Catholic woman who was forced, decades earlier, to give up her son to her local convent. Though initially reluctant to deal in a human interest story, Sixsmith agrees to help Philomena uncover the truth of the convent's role in events and to see if her son can be found.
Philomena, how are you?
I had a hip replacement last year, Martin. Titanium, so it won't rust.
Otherwise, I'd have to oil you like the Tin Man.
Is that right?
Oh, no.
He's just joking, Mum.
Oh. I was going to ask if it'd be possible not to use my real name when you write the story. What about Anne Boleyn? That's a lovely name. Well, somebody had that.
We're going to have to use your real name, Philomena.
I only want to know if he's all right.
Perhaps these older nuns should help us with some of the details.
I don't think that's going to be possible.
Why not?
You're a journalist.
I used to be.
Martin's a Roman Catholic.
Yes, well, no, I used to be. My guess is that Anthony was adopted and sent to America.
I think I would like to go. I'd like to know if Anthony ever thought of me. I've thought of him every day. I've never been to Mexico, but I believe it's lovely. Apart from the kidnappings.
Emma, Philomena is a complex mix of genres, including mismatched buddy comedy, detective mystery, and family drama. But does it manage to blend them into a coherent whole?
Yes, I thought so. That's a long question. I'm going to give a short answer. Yes. I saw this last night, and I was expecting to enjoy it because I'd seen the trailers, and you know, you get a feel for that. That trailer gives a very good feel for what it's going to be like. But it exceeded my expectations, and that is even with the incredible, you know, with very, very good critical reviews that have been coming its way. It takes what is this, you know, heartbreaking story, and it's a heartbreaking story, and it's an incredible story, and it's full of pathos and injustice and love and humour. And I think I want to give Steve Coogan and whoever it was who co-wrote it with him, I think the script is brilliant. I think because it is a rare occasion that you sit in the cinema and you are simultaneously crying and laughing. But I really did in this. You know, your heart gets broken, but it is written with humour and humanity. And I don't think he over-sentimentalises what is, you know, a very, very, you know, like I said, tragic story and just with so much in it. And they just put it out there on the screen. And I think, again, it's a short film. It's 98 minutes. And he and Judy Dench have a chemistry that maybe you wouldn't expect, but they are excellent together. And just for me, I found it a profoundly moving and amusing night at the cinema, and I couldn't ask much more than that. I think they've done a really, really good job.
Steph, in terms of the two lead roles, Steve Coogan and Judi Dench, there's almost an absence, or maybe even a conscious desire to not sentimentalise those characters and their aspects of the story. Martin Sixsmith comes into the story being standoffish and almost stays that way through the entire course of the film. Do you think that works in its favour, or actually would it work better being slightly more traditional?
I think I've probably got to position any reply I give before I actually give it. Much like Emma, I was very much looking forward to this. I love Stephen Frears as a director. I think Judi Dench is fantastic. Steve Coogan, I think, is very good. And I had very high hopes for this. It's a fantastic story. The idea of a young woman giving up her child and then keeping silent for 50 years. And then suddenly this search happening, and the fact that it's a true story just filled me just full of hope before I got to the cinema. But that's where it stopped. The film, for me, fell a little flat, and I've been racking my brains trying to work out where that lies, whether or not it was a script or whether or not it was actually the relationship between the two central characters. So whether or not they were standoffish, I can't say whether or not that worked, but something didn't work, and maybe it was that. Martin Sixsmith is portrayed as very, very ironic and sarcastic almost all the time. So when he breaks with that, you know it's kind of an emotional moment, even if he doesn't really show it. And Judi Dench as Philomena was somebody who let her immediate feelings show, but anything very, very deep, much like the story that she held for 50 years, she keeps buried. And so when there's something that she actually feels very strongly and she reveals that, that's, again, a very big moment. And in those times when one of them was suddenly acting out of type, the film soared. For 3, 4, 5 minutes at a time, it was absolutely brilliant and gripping. And then it stopped. And for me, and I'm guessing not for Emma, it then just nosedived and just kind of just plodded along again. And that, for me, wasn't enough. So something didn't work for me.
I think, Emma, you were saying before we came on air that you had a certain amount of empathy with Judi Dench's character because you have a young child the same age as Philomena's was.
For sure, I think I describe myself as probably target audience, yes, and I am a well-known... I love a good weepy, I'm not going to lie. My mother even had a full pack of tissues ready for me in her handbag to hand over to me halfway through. But what I enjoyed so much about this was the fact that, like I say, you were laughing, but it did make you... crying, but it made you laugh at the same time. And this is where I'll take umbrage a bit with what Steph says. I think, maybe Martin Sixsmith is, you know, yes, Steve Coogan gives himself, obviously, some good, throwaway, amusing lines. You'd expect that. And there is also... But what I was impressed about is sometimes it's very hard to, as you said in your lead into this, sometimes it's very hard to remove Steve Coogan from Alan Partridge or other characters he did. And in this, I was completely convinced by him as Martin Sixsmith. I think, if anything, you expect Judi Dench to be great. She is a national treasure. Steve Coogan may be working his way up to that, I don't know. But he was the one that exceeded my expectations in this film in terms of his character. But yes, for sure, as a parent of a young boy like that, and you know, and they do, I think they do that beautifully, because you see it all as if unrolling as a kind of home movies almost. And I thought that was a really beautiful device. And you know, the idea that this son has this life that she, you know, that she imagines in her head through these kind of home movies is just beautiful and heartbreaking. And I guess being a mother of, and imagining if my child was taken from me at this age now, and then me having to sit there for 50 years imagining how he is and what's going on, it certainly added another emotional layer for me. So I guess I have to say that. But I don't want to detract from the film in any way whatsoever by saying that. I don't want it to just sound like I'm a big sap, so I loved it.
Yeah, with the two of you coming in with your opinions, is this one that we think is going to fall across a gender divide? Is there an age difference in the type of audience that would potentially get something from this film?
Quite possibly, because neither my father nor my husband would come with me and my mother to go and see it, so I'm not. But there were three, I'm going to say this, there were three, maybe 50 to 60-year-old guys in the cinema who were hooting with laughter throughout the entire thing. Absolutely loved it. And they'd come together, three guys, loving it.
I think you might be right on the age divide. When I went to see it, I think it was Wednesday, there were the biggest laughs were coming from the older members of the audience. So it might well be that there is something in the writing that's just hitting a particular generation. Because I mean, some of Judy Dench's lines are very funny, and coming from her when she's quite quiet, quite not refined, but quite restrained, and throughout most of the film, and she then says some quite outlandish things, were I did find very funny, and other people in the cinema were, yeah, hooting with laughter.
I think, and I would say as well that I think it does a very good job, this film, in wrapping up what is extremely, you know, a very unpalatable truth at the heart of it. And there is a lot of anger at the heart of this film. And there is this lovely juxtaposition between Martin Sixsmith, who just can't see beyond this anger, and Judy Dench, who is kind of, you know, or Philomena, who is conflicted through her deep, deep religious beliefs, you know, and a need to forgive. And that there's a kind of beauty. It doesn't answer that necessarily, but I like the fact that they kind of wrap it up into what is essentially a mismatched buddy comedy in an hour and a half. And I think it asks some very difficult questions and brings up some very unpleasant truths in the framework of a kind of slightly jolly English.
And did you both feel it got deeply enough into some of those areas, particularly the aspect of the way in which the convents had sold some of these children, as becomes quickly apparent?
I think we might be split on that one again.
Well, I would just say that it would be if it gets more deeply into it, would be a very different film. I think it asks those questions, and, you know, as a film audience, sometimes it's your responsibility, if you're interested in something that films bring up, to go and look into it yourself. So I think as a piece of art, as a piece of entertainment, it worked very well. It hit that level, just very, very, you know, in an interesting way. It encompasses it, like I say, in a kind of jolly comedy, but at the heart of it, there is some really raw anger and passion there.
For me, it made me want to read Martin Sixsmith's book, because it is a truly fantastic story, absolutely fascinating, and one that I didn't feel being told to my satisfaction by the film. So I was intrigued by the story, and I did want to go deeper, but whether or not a film could actually engage with that well, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think at this point, having stereotyped half the audience to death will leave people to make their own judgment. And I will take full accountability for having driven that gender divide down the middle of that debate.
I don't think it's a gender divide. I don't think at all. I think it was. It's just a really, really good film. Listen to the critics and to me, and maybe a bit to Steph.
Philomena opened last weekend and is still screening at all three Cambridge cinemas, and it's a certificate 12A.
Local and proud of it.
Community radio in your city. We are Cambridge 105.
Missed one of your favourite shows? Well, don't despair. Head over to Cambridge105.fm, where you can download a selection of show podcasts, featuring regular podcasts from our business programme In Your Company, film reviews from Bums on Seats, everything that's tasty and refreshing with our food and drink show, Flavour, plus replays of guest interviews from 105 Breakfast and 105 Drive. There's something on offer for everyone. Get downloading now at Cambridge105.fm.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. This autumn, oddly incorporated into the BFI's series of Gothic horror screenings, the Cambridge Arts Picture House is offering a rare chance to see a five features from the famous and hugely influential Czech animator Jan Švankmajer. It begins this coming Monday, November the 11th, with Alice, his 1988 adaptation of Lewis Carroll's tale, and simply one of the finest animated films ever made. Following on from Alice are screenings of four of Švankmajer's other features, Little Otik, Conspirators of Pleasure, Faust and Lunacy, as well as a brace of classic short films, including The Fall of the House of Usher and Punch and Judy. As a preview to this season, regular Bums on Seats host Toby Miller spoke to film academic Michael Brook, a freelance writer who has extensively written about Eastern European film, including articles and booklets on Švankmajer, and has conducted a rare interview with the director himself. The chat was supposed to be an introduction to Svankmajer's work, but quickly turned to a discussion on the director's many and varied inspirations, his obsessive fascination with the texture of objects, and the vital role surrealism has played in Czech cinema. But Toby began by asking Michael Brook about whether Svankmajer saw his own films as animation, when they came across as live-action films that just happened to star the weirdest of objects.
Yes, I think that's very fair indeed. He doesn't like being described as an animator. One of his great obsessions is with what he calls the inner life of objects, which is, if you sort of take an object, it's going to have some kind of characteristic markings. It's going to be sort of developing its own history. And he's obsessed with trying to capture that through all sorts of methods, including extreme close-up filmmaking to emphasize their texture and so on. And so there is a very tangible, tactile feel to his films.
I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about his background and influences.
He didn't train as a filmmaker originally. He studied puppetry in what was, I think at the time, the world's only degree-level puppetry course. It's very important to bear in mind that puppetry is a serious adult art form in Central Europe in general, and the Czech Republic in particular. The first film that he worked on was a film called Johannes Dr. Faust, which was a puppet film. And he was fascinated by the possibilities of the medium. And he became a very close friend of Emil Radok, who was the director, who went on to become a major player in the Laterna Magica multimedia theatre, which in 1958 wowed people at the Brussels World's Fair. And this was a completely multimedia theatre that combined live action, puppetry, film, all incredibly carefully synchronized. And Schwenkmayr actually worked for them in the early 60s.
Oh, I can see that influence, especially with the films that are screening in November and December. I can certainly see that in The Castle of Otranto, the way it's almost a sketchbook of all these techniques.
Czechoslovakia certainly has a very, very strong animation history. There have been very distinguished animators before Schwenkmayr. One of the most distinguished was a man called Jiří Trnka, who was certainly in the late 50s, certainly in the 50s and early 60s, probably the greatest puppet animator in the world. And Schwenkmayr actually worked at Trnka's studio for part of the 1960s. He made Punch and Judy there. And they were absolutely world-class in terms of creative, certainly the sort of technology of animation. Trnka's work is very, very different from Schwenkmayr's. In terms, his stuff is much smoother, much more carefully crafted, much less violent. And by violent, I mean the way that Schwenkmayr actually cuts film, I think, is incredibly violent.
You mentioned the editing there and the harshness of the editing. Rewatching some of the short films last night, in particular Punch and Judy, the editing is extraordinary, and it reminded me of Daisies, which, again, I can't think of a precedent for that style of editing in feature films or animation before that.
Yes, I mean, I think that's true. Schwenkmayr has said that his primary influence with the sort of great Soviet filmmakers of the 20s, which was Eisenstein, Pudovkin, people like that. Although I think Schwenkmayr's method is somewhat different, particularly the way he combines it with animation. I mean, sometimes his live action editing is right down to, you know, sort of individual frames. I think sort of Soviet montage has rather fallen out of, actually, it was never that influential despite its colossal impact. And so when someone like Schwenkmayr picks up on it, it looks really quite startlingly different.
His use of sound and especially score is extraordinary. And whether he was animating to pre-compose scores, in the case of his shorts, I'm mainly thinking now, or whether he has scores officially commissioned and...
Surprisingly, the answer is no, the music came later. He was very lucky to become a good friend with a man called Zdeněk Liška, who I seriously think is one of the greatest film composers of all time. And I think it's only because he worked exclusively in communist Czechoslovakia that he's not as well known as Ennio Morricone or Nino Rota or people like that. He has the most astonishingly fertile musical imagination. And Schwenkmayr, the quote he gave about Liška was, he said that the amazing thing about Liška is that he was able to find rhythms in my films that I didn't know were there. And in fact, when Liška died in the early 1980s, Schwenkmayr said he felt a fairly strong aversion towards using music in films because he just didn't think that Liška was replaceable. And in fact, since then, he's generally worked with sort of pre-composed scores and sort of library music and stuff like that.
Does he work with a team of animators? How does he handle his bigger productions?
He does work with a regular team, and you'll see the same names popping up again and again. One of the most crucial names is Bezhlik Glaser, who is he started working with him from, I think, The Fall of the House of Usher onwards. It's no coincidence that from that film onwards, Schwenkmayr's films tended to feature a lot more claymation, because that's Glaser's great speciality. Glaser is a sculptor, and Schwenkmayr has said he has this amazing sort of three-dimensional conceptual imagination that Schwenkmayr himself doesn't have.
A over the recent Cambridge Film Festival, we had a small group of new or relatively new Catalonian films, and there was a thread of Catalonian surrealism that obviously goes back to Buñuel and before. And I ran an article that surrealism is art form at its strongest when it's under some form of oppression.
Yes, I think that's very true. And actually, Schwenkmayr is very interesting about this, because he said that he grew up under Nazi occupation. Then there was sort of Stalinism. Then there was the post-1968 so-called normalization of communism. And then there was consumer capitalism. And he says, with a completely straight face, and I think he is absolutely serious, that he regards what we're living through now as being just as oppressive as anything that he's lived through before. And I think understanding that mindset is a key to how his films work. He is constantly rebelling against something.
What was the role of surrealism in Czech filmmaking of the mid to late 60s and early 70s? I mentioned Daisies there, which is obviously the famous one. And even Valerie in her Week of Wonders features imagery that's similar to Schwenkmayr's films. And I was wondering what role he played within that. That it wasn't a collective, he was sort of outside it a little bit.
I think one thing that needs emphasising is that out of all the countries that have embraced surrealism, I think Czechoslovakia, as was, is probably second only to France. They had a very active, very creative surrealist group dating from the 1930s onwards, who met with their French counterparts. And they carried on being active throughout the 50s and 60s, with usually as a sort of underground clandestine organisation. And then Schwenkmayr, after a lot of conversations with Vratislav Effenberger, who is one of the leading lights of the Czech Surrealist group, joined them formally in 1968. And so I think he was the first Czech filmmaker who was actually a card-carrying surrealist.
Could you explain a little bit of what the work he was doing from 74 onwards that led to the work that audiences can see in The Fall of the House of Usher? The making of almost everything in the world into a sentient object. It reminds me more of Richard Long or Andy Goldsworthy than any filmmaker.
Absolutely. The Fall of the House of Usher, which is a really, really fascinating film. There are no human characters at all. The story is actually imprinted into the fabric of the house and the surroundings in a way that's very, very hard to describe, as with a lot of Schwenkmayr films. And that all came out of his tactile experiments. Conspirators of Pleasure, one of my absolute favourite Schwenkmayr films. He actually wrote it in the 70s. But he made it in the 90s in exactly the way he would have made it in the 70s. And his idea was he wanted to make the world's first entirely pornographic film that didn't contain a single pornographic image. And the idea was that no censor would be able to cut it without effectively admitting that they had a dirty mind, because they would see things, depraved things, that were totally intentional in Schwenkmayr's part, but could be interpreted innocently.
Its roots seem to be finding a way around censorship that he would have lived a great deal of his filmmaking life with.
Yes, I'm delighted he made Conspirators of Pleasure the same way he would have done had he been able to make it under communism, because it's much, much more subversive, it's much funnier. And yes, he was constantly, constantly isn't the right word, because he was making animated short films. They generally left him alone because he was seen as being such a marginal figure that it didn't matter. He only came on their radar for the first time in about 1970. And then by the 80s, they were doing things like, and Schwenkmayr said this with some pride, his film Dimensions of Dialogue was actually shown to official Czechoslovak communist circles as an example of the kind of film that should not be made. In other words, they thought it was offensive, but they couldn't work out exactly why it was offensive. And so they thought, okay, not only are we going to ban it, but we're actually going to show it behind the scenes to discourage people from doing anything similar.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Screenwriting theory encompasses a wide variety of opinions, from those who believe it's the only way to find truth in your characters to those who believe it should be anathema to any budding screenwriter. With Short Term 12, Destin Daniel Cretton may have confounded some of those academics by taking the short film he wrote and directed in 2008 and making a significant inversion in bringing it to feature length by switching his lead character from male to female. Brie Larson takes on the role of Grace, a supervisor rather than a counsellor, but still attempting to keep order at a foster home in the charges in her care. She's troubled by her own past, even before her immediate future throws her life into turmoil. But despite this, or maybe because of it, the relationship she forms with the children at the home are intense. From long-term inmate Marcus, whose quiet intensity may be matched only by Grace's, to new resident Jaden, whose experiences and emotions hold up a mirror to Grace, she attempts to make sense of the young lives around her while keeping at a safe distance.
Short-term 12, this is Grace. Remember, you're not their parent, you're not their therapist. You are here to create a safe environment, and that's it.
Got it.
Luis, you better be up.
So this is how I was gonna be.
I am on the floor every day with those kids, and last night, that girl sat next to me, and she cried, and she tried to tell me the only way that she knew how.
Grace, it's not your job to interpret tears.
I've been waiting for 3 years for you to just once take the advice that you give your kids every 5 minutes and learn to talk about what's going on inside your head.
So let's all lift our glasses to our king and queen. Everything good in my life is because of you.
You know we can do this, Ray.
Here we go.
Simon, Short-Term 12 is a frank and revealing look at the lives of troubled teenagers, but does it have anything new to say about those youngsters or their relationships?
I'm not sure whether it's got anything new to say, but the way it's told is quite new. Start off before I can think of anything else at the moment, this film is absolutely fantastic. It was such a wonderful surprise to see it. And just how deep and affecting it was. It deals with the problems the teens have, and the adults who help him with it at the short-term foster home, which is, you know, an area which I don't think I have really seen represented in film before, where the people looking after them aren't much older than the kids themselves and still have their own problems and hang-ups and issues that they are also dealing with alongside the kids. The film doesn't try to give any easy answers. It shows, like I said, a lot of the kids in trouble and when they're asking for help and stuff, but it doesn't give any easy answers. A lot of the times after the kids, you know, open up to what the problem is, the only solution are they just hug them, because there is no answer, there is no thing. And through that, it had a real authenticity to it. It could also almost have been a documentary that I was watching, because it was just, the performances were so, you know, fantastic and spot on and everything. It was just so gripping. It was, you know, heartbreaking at times, yet still funny. There's lots of humour in the story.
And Steph, Brie Larson in particular has garnered a lot of acclaim for her performance. How did you find the performances in general, also from a lot of unknown actors and actresses?
Absolutely mesmerising. Simon mentioned that it felt a bit like a documentary. It felt real. Whenever you've got an ensemble cast with over half the cast as young teenagers, you're kind of going to be expecting a few lines to slip or a few performances not to feel real and for that to knock you out of the film. It didn't. It was every single performance just nailed that that child. And Brie Larson was... I've got to mention John Gallagher Jr. as well as Mason. Brie Larson and John Gallagher were... It was basically a two-hander between them. It focused mostly on her, but he was the foil against which she played. And they were both absolutely brilliant.
There's a balance between that dynamic of Grace and Mason, and then the relationships with the children, and exploring various different of those relationships. Again, is that a good balance in terms of the time the film spends with each of those relationships?
It is a good balance. One of the things I noticed about this film is there's not a lot of explanation. It doesn't set you up for a story or a plot line. It doesn't it doesn't even say what short-term 12 means or what the... You just got to kind of work it out for yourself. And everyone doesn't have a nice potted story where you get, you know, conclusion. It's just like real sections from life. So it is all about the characters. It's about the characters and the relationships and how they deal with things between each other.
Well, they deliberately do hide some of the issues in the film. There's a moment they introduce the short-term 12 by bringing in a new member of staff, somebody on his gap year who wants to spend a bit of time with the kids and work with them. And so you start off seeing things through his eyes just to get you into the film. And at one point, there's an office area separate to the home where they've got everybody's files. And he is told that here are all the files and all the kids, so you can find out what's wrong with them. At no point did they let us into that. So we find out the experiences that the children have had and why they're there quite late on in the film, and some of them not at all. And that I think was really intriguing. You get to see them as characters, not as problems. You get to see them as kind of fully formed individuals who are trying to work something out rather than the thing they're trying to work out. And it takes the same approach with the leads in the film, in that it peels off layers from them as the film progresses. You mentioned that Caitlin Dever plays Jaden, who is somebody who arrives new to the centre. And you took the words out of my mouth. You mentioned that she is a mirror which Grace kind of holds up to herself. And she is that role. She is the character that allows her to see herself more clearly and for us to see her more clearly. So you get... It's a character film. You get... not so much development of character, but revealing of character as the film goes on.
Yeah, I did point out that you have used character a lot there, but to be honest, the performance is so good, they're people. You know, they don't just appear to be a character's written and thing and feeling, well, these are actually people fully rounded with problems and, you know, how they deal with it. And it's just such a spot-on film. It is... I mean, it's so lucky that we've actually got two films, at least this show, which, you know, definitely going to make it in the final top 10 of the year. This is almost as good as Gravity.
Possibly three for Emma.
I haven't seen Short-Term 12, but yeah, Philomena's right up there.
I haven't seen Philomena, so...
To just play devil's advocate quickly and slightly, the one thing that I found slightly problematic with the film was a couple of the plot developments later on. I won't say too much about them, so not to spoil anyone's enjoyment, but... in particular, a couple of the choices that Grace makes, and then also a reveal about one of the children and the sort of longer standing of that child's time at the home and how their relationship is panning out, to me didn't quite feel real. But actually, is that a case that real life doesn't feel real? Real life sometimes throws surprises at us. Is that more of a reflection?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's she reacts strangely, but I think part of the point is... You know, when you've been affected by things that you see and the relationships, you don't necessarily make the most, you know, sane choices. I know what you're saying. I don't want to say too much for anybody who hasn't seen it. But I can easily overlook it for everything else that's in this film. And the bit at the end where you find out more about one of the characters, I just loved and just thought it was a perfect finish. And... maybe a bit too much for a happy ending, if you want, with the way it's actually shot. But I thought the film, you definitely deserved it.
I'd go further than that. There's one point where Brie Larson as Grace makes a very unwise choice on the face of it. But I thought it fitted with the character. It was a cathartic moment for her, where she... And it was a turning point in the film for her as a character. And so it just I think it just served to make her feel a little bit more real.
Another set of strong recommendations. Short-term 12 is a certificate 15. Sadly, it's finished its short run at the Arts Picture House, but if you're feeling adventurous, it's still playing at the Hackney Picture House, where Picture House members can claim a normal discount, and in London, or it's released on Blu-ray and DVD on the 13th of January next year. 5 years since Marvel Studios took it upon themselves to bring their comic creations to the big screen with the first Iron Man, there seems to be no end to their ambition. Last year's The Avengers was the grand finale of stage one of their plan for global domination, the culmination of a series of standalone blockbusters featuring increasingly unlikely role models, which brought a plethora of heroes together to fight generic evil aliens in a fanboy or fangirl's dream. Now, following Iron Man 3's launch of Marvel's Phase 2 earlier this year, Thor gets his second bite of the cherry with Thor: The Dark World, a sequel which foregoes the small-scale border town setting of the first film to throw the audience into the full fantastical glory of Asgard and the Nine Realms. Chris Hemsworth is once again the hammer-wielding God of Thunder, who's been busy in the months since helping save New York by bringing peace to the outlying regions of the Allfather's Kingdom. But the return of an enemy older than the universe itself, the Dark Elves, led by Christopher Eccleston's vengeful Malekith, brings Thor back to Earth, where a rather disgruntled Natalie Portman soon has more on her plate than a domestic with a demigod.
I gave you my word. I would return.
What's gonna happen?
Hold on.
Wait, what?
Jane!
We're from different worlds. Maybe they're separate for a reason.
If we do nothing, they'll destroy us.
Ask yourself, what will you sacrifice for what you believe? No! You must be truly desperate to come to me for help.
You should know that when you betray me, I will kill you.
Steph, this is now the eighth trip up the... This is now the eighth trip to the well of this Marvel universe, and our second trip up the Bifrost to Asgard. So is familiarity now breeding contempt or contentment?
Certainly not contempt. It was a light film, fun to watch. The story would... seemed merely incidental as a backdrop to this kind of this buddy comedy action flick with Norse gods, and all it dragged. I thought it dragged a little bit in the first kind of 20-30 minutes until you got Loki and Thor together. Once the two of them were on screen together, the chemistry between them and the comedy between them, I thought, was absolutely fantastic. So I wouldn't put it on my top 10 list. I wouldn't be watching it again and again, but I absolutely loved it.
Blimey. I think I may have seen a different film from you.
as this is a radio show, I'll have to explain that Emma's reaction was rather startled to that comment. Emma, your thoughts?
The bit about the comedy, I really don't think I laughed once in this film. That was what it lacked for me. I you know, amusingly called it the big snore. Snore 2, bore 2, whatever. No, that's rude. I enjoyed Thor. I enjoyed Iron Man 3. I enjoyed The Avengers. I fear that, you know, I guess Marvel, like any other studio, not every film is going to, you know, they're not all going to be as good as each other. They've all got different things to bring to the table. This obviously has the addition of delightful Chris Hemsworth. But I won't get into that because I feel I covered him in Rush, my last review on here. But no, I don't know. I didn't find it at all funny. I thought it felt like there were minutes, if not hours, it felt to me, where there's no dialogue at all, just kind of muddled fighting on different realms, different worlds. But Chris Eccleston gets a terrible deal as Malekith, because I guess really we're still focusing on Loki as the main Marvel baddie, not baddie. So with Loki, and Tom Hiddleston is great, and Chris Hemsworth, I can't think of anyone better I would have as Thor, but the whole humans and that, just the story... It just felt muddled, it made no sense to me, and I didn't laugh, and it didn't entertain me very much. So yeah, I think it was a different film.
Well, I'll 100% agree with you on Chris Eccleston. If you are a Christopher Eccleston fan and you're going to see this film to watch him, don't bother. You can play spot Chris Eccleston. If you don't know who he's playing, you can actually spend the film trying to work out which prosthetics he's hiding underneath, and eventually you hear his voice and go, okay, that's him. But he really didn't need him.
I didn't even recognise him in the film. It wasn't until the end credits that I knew even Chris Eccleston was in it.
There you go.
Simon, Alan Taylor was brought in to direct this. Marvel seem to have this roster of revolving directors they bring in, and Alan Taylor obviously having a background from Game of Thrones. Do we think that benefited the battle scenes and the action? Game of Thrones not particularly known for its battle scenes when all said and done. How did it work as an action spectacle?
It was quite good. It's hard to say. I saw this as a part of a double bill at the cinema. So I came straight from Thor to Thor 2, and it reminded me, because it's probably one of the least watched Marvel film of mine, that how much I loved Thor, and how good the direction was by Kenneth Branagh. So, as a standalone Thor 2 for an action film, yes, it's fine. It's good. The action. It wasn't until the last, like the finale fight, that there was anything truly exciting. But I thought the final fight was fantastic, really imaginative and inventive, and it's the one thing that really did give the film a big boost. But compared to Kenneth Branagh, it, you know, it's not the same. It's not necessarily meant to be the same, but the two styles did it seemed more generic with that rather than the big scenes.
For me, definitely, I think the first one had a bit more of that kind of idea of when Thor, and I know this is set in the Nine Realms, so it's a bit different, but what you missed then maybe is this idea of Thor the demigod being on Earth, because that is ripe for kind of amusement factor.
It's amusement. That was, it's a fish out of water, yeah. No powers.
And that was mined quite a lot, I thought, in the first one. And in this one, there was one bit where he gets into a car with Kat Dennings, you know, Natalie Portman's kind of sidekick, and that amused me because it's just huge Thor in this ridiculous car because they're in London and, you know, they're driving that little kind of station wagon or whatever. It could have done with more of that. For me, it could have done with more of that.
Yeah, it was more of he is a god. It's all set. Most of it is set. The humans are just MacGuffins in this film. I feel sorry for Natalie Portman. But I did actually find the film quite funny. And the biggest jokes were in some of the most shocking moments of the film and biggest, most dramatic moments when they pulled off the biggest jokes. And I thought that was really daring, and it worked. Overall, I wouldn't rate it in the highest amongst of the Marvel films, but I did enjoy it. It's only afterwards I can start thinking about all the flaws.
But at the time, I
loved it.
It's a film that I think feels slightly conscious of the amount of characters that's developed already. You get the feeling of trying to give more screen time to the likes of Rene Russo, Idris Elba, some of the supporting characters. Are these Marvel films at risk of imploding under the weight of their own character roster?
Well, it's a difficult one. And I think he's a particularly difficult character because whenever you have a superhero film, the interesting thing about the superhero is the flaws, is the weaknesses. And when you start off with a god, and you start putting him amongst humans, it's very difficult to find those. And so I think it's the same thing that makes Superman very difficult to film. To actually write a good film about somebody who is a god is tricky. And so for me, the way you actually make this work is you find the weaknesses and you find the comedy. And for me, the thing that made this film just babble along nicely was the interaction and the witty comedy and the visual gags that happened throughout it. Without those, I don't think there would have been a lot left.
I swear I didn't see this, but I see where you're coming from, because I think one of the things that this did for me as well was to kind of waste. I do think Chris Hemsworth is a very I think he's got great screen presence and he is very charismatic, and this wasted that in a way that maybe the first Thor didn't. And I too, like Simon, I think I put it down to the
but
direction.
he did have a topless scene in it.
Not enough. Very early on, though.
I think there's been
very early on.
there's been a couple of observations that I've seen that Chris Hemsworth's character comes into the first Thor as brashy, immature. He's the cocky prince who needs to be taught a bit of a lesson. He then learns those lessons in Thor and the Avengers, and by the time we get to this, he's matured. That's his character arc.
He's like Anthony Hopkins, like kind of thing. You've got Anthony Hopkins and him. Maybe you don't need them both.
Has that actually done Chris Hemsworth and Thor a disservice by almost giving nowhere to go in that character arc?
I felt so in this film. Like I say, I think Chris Hemsworth himself doesn't have a lot to do with Thor, the character, and it didn't feel like it used him as well as it could do as a performer. I would say Tom Hiddleston, on the other hand, gets a lot more to work with than Chris Hemsworth does.
I'd agree with that, certainly.
And I suppose the other question to ask is, we've debated the 2D and the 3D. Has anyone got any particular views on this? Because it's a radically different proposition.
I saw it in 3D. I love 3D. I can't see the point of the 3D in this. I think it is a conversion, and conversions normally see in 2D. Probably doesn't make much difference.
I saw it in 3D, which I wouldn't normally do. I did that because it was a date night, and I know my husband likes 3D more than me, so we went on 3D. But I find fight scenes, I find them really, because the darkness, I just find it looks more muddled in 3D, and there tends to be one part, and I think maybe it would have worked better in 2D.
As I said, I saw the 2D, so I didn't have a double bill, so I didn't have a choice between 2D or 3D. It was just shown in 3D, but if I chose, I probably would have seen the 2D first.
I think my gut feel would be the same as that, 2D if possible.
Saw The Dark World open last weekend and split our audience like Mulder on a lump of granite. It's both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas in both 2D and 3D, and it is, you guessed it, a certificate 12A. And that's all we've got time for on the show today. The whole shebang will be available as a Cambridge 105 podcast in a few days. Remember to follow our Twitter and Facebook posts and pages if you want to find out more. We'll be back in a fortnight's time on November the 23rd with a show featuring the perfect mix of a smorgasbord of villains, presidents, young lovers and career criminals. Ridley Scott sets aside the epics for a moment to make The Counselor, a nasty little drug cartel thriller from the pen of Cormac McCarthy. Only a few months since the southern gothic of The Paperboy, director Lee Daniels returns with The Butler, 34 years of American president seen through the eyes of Forrest Whitaker's White House manservant. Dom Hemingway finds safecracker Jude Law released from prison back to a world he believes owes him big time. And Blue is the Warmest Colour finally opens, a winner at Cannes, but hounded by controversy since, with both director and star seeming to turn their back on the film. We'll take a detour back to the Czech Republic to wrap up the show, with some of Zdeněk Liška's masterfully strained score for Marteka Lazarova. Please stay tuned for Saturday Lunch, but from everyone here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.
Stáhni ruku svou z výsosti. Sešli hromovití. Padej na ně uhlíře řavy.